Part 5. Homefront USA. Taos, New Mexico. Arthur Sinclair, Jr. is the picture of an old-world patrician. Tall, lean, with close-cropped white hair. He speaks into the ether, rarely pausing for questions. During the war, Mr. Sinclair was director of the U.S. government's newly formed DSTRES, or Department of Strategic Resources.
I don't know who first thought of the acronym DSTRES, or if they consciously knew how much it sounded like distress, but it certainly could not have been more appropriate. Establishing a defensive line at the Rocky Mountains might have created a theoretical safe zone, but in reality, that zone consisted mainly of rubble and refugees. There was starvation, disease, homelessness in the millions. Industry was in shambles. Transportation and trade had evaporated. And all of this was compounded by the living dead, both assaulting the Rocky line and festering within our safe zone. We had to get our people on their feet again, clothed, fed, housed, back to work. Otherwise, this supposed safe zone was only forestalling the inevitable. That was why distress was created. And as you can imagine, I had a lot of on-the-job training. Those first months, I can't tell you how much information I had to cram into this withered old cortex. The briefings, the inspection tours. When I did sleep, it was with a book under my pillow. Each night, a new one, from Henry J. Kaiser to Vo Nguyen Giap. I needed every lesson, every word, every ounce of knowledge and wisdom to help me fuse a fractured landscape into the modern American war machine. If my father had been alive, he probably would have laughed at my frustration. He'd been a staunch New Dealer, working closely with FDR as controller of New York State. He used methods that were almost Marxist in nature, the kind of collectivization that would make Ayn Rand leap from her grave and join the ranks of the living dead. I'd always rejected the wisdom he tried to impart, running as far away as Wall Street to shut it out. Now I was racking my brains to remember it. One thing those New Dealers did better than any generation in American history was find and harvest the right tools and talent.
Tools and talent?
A term my son heard once in a movie. I found it described our reconstruction efforts rather well. Talent describes the potential workforce, its level of skilled labor, and how that labor can be utilized effectively. To be perfectly candid, our supply of talent was at a critical low. Ours was a post-industrial or service-based economy, so complex and highly specialized that each individual could only function within the confines of its narrow compartmentalized structure. You should have seen some of the careers listed on our first employment census. Everyone was some version of an executive or a representative, an analyst or a consultant, all perfectly suited to the pre-war world, but all totally inadequate for the present crisis. We needed carpenters, masons, machinists, gunsmiths. We had those people, to be sure, but not nearly as many as were necessary. The first labor survey stated clearly that over 65% of the present civilian workforce were classified F6, possessing no valued vocation. We required a massive job retraining program. In short, we needed to get a lot of white collars dirty. It was slow going. Air traffic was non-existent. Roads and rail lines were a shambles. And fuel. Good Lord, you couldn't find a tank of gas between Blaine, Washington and Imperial Beach, California. Add to this the fact that pre-war America not only had a commuter-based infrastructure, but that such a method also allowed for severe levels of economic segregation. You would have entire suburban neighborhoods of upper-middle-class professionals, none of whom had possessed even the basic know-how to replace a cracked window. Those with that knowledge lived in their own blue-collar ghettos, an hour away in pre-war auto traffic, which translated to at least a full day on foot. Make no mistake, bipedal locomotion was how most people traveled in the beginning. Solving this problem, no, challenge, there were no problems, was the refugee camps. There were hundreds of them. Some parking lots small, some spreading for miles, scattered across the mountains and coast, all requiring government assistance, all acute drains on rapidly diminishing resources. At the top of my list, before I tackled any other challenge, these camps had to be emptied. Anyone F6 but physically able became unskilled labor, clearing rubble, harvesting crops, digging graves. A lot of graves had to be dug. Anyone A1, those with war-appropriate skills, became part of our CSSP, or Community Self-Sufficiency Program, A mixed group of instructors would be tasked with infusing these sedentary, overeducated, desk-bound cubicle mice with the knowledge necessary to make it on their own. It was an instant success. Within 3 months, you saw a marked drop in requests for government aid. I can't stress how vital this was to victory. It allowed us to transition from a zero-sum survival-based economy into full-blown war production. This was the National Reeducation Act, the organic outgrowth of the CSSP. I'd say it was the largest jobs training program since the Second World War, and easily the most radical in our history.
You've mentioned on occasion the problems faced by the NRA.
I was getting to that. The president gave me the kind of power I needed to meet any physical or logistical challenge. Unfortunately, what neither he nor anyone on Earth could give me was the power to change the way people thought. As I explained, America was a segregated workforce. And in many cases, that segregation contained a cultural element. A great many of our instructors were first-generation immigrants. These were the people who knew how to take care of themselves, how to survive on very little and work with what they had. These were the people who tended small gardens in their backyards, who repaired their own homes, who kept their appliances running for as long as mechanically possible. It was crucial that these people teach the rest of us to break from our comfortable, disposable consumer lifestyle, even though their labor had allowed us to maintain that lifestyle in the first place. Yes, there was racism, but there was also classism. You're a high-powered corporate attorney. You've spent most of your life reviewing contracts, brokering deals, talking on the phone. That's what you're good at. That's what's made you rich and what's allowed you to hire a plumber to fix your toilet, which allowed you to keep talking on the phone. The more work you do, the more money you make. The more peons you hire to free you up to make more money. That's the way the world works. But one day it doesn't. No one needs a contract reviewed or a deal brokered. What they do need is toilets fixed. And suddenly that peon is your teacher, maybe even your boss. For some, this was scarier than the living dead. Once on a fact-finding tour through L.A., I sat in the back of a re-education lecture. The trainees had all held lofty positions in the entertainment industry. A mélange of agents, managers, creative executives, whatever the hell that means. I could understand their resistance, their arrogance. Before the war, entertainment had been the most valued export of the United States. Now they were being trained as custodians for a munitions plant in Bakersfield, California. One woman, a casting director, exploded. How dare they degrade her like this? She had an MFA in conceptual theater. She had cast the top three grossing sitcoms in the last 5 seasons, and she had made more in a week than her instructor could dream of in several lifetimes. She kept addressing that instructor by her first name. Magda, she kept saying. Magda, enough already. Magda, please. At first, I thought this woman was just being rude, degrading the instructor by refusing to use her title. I found out later that Mrs. Magda Antonova used to be this woman's cleaning lady. Yes, it was very hard for some, but a lot of them later admitted that they got more emotional satisfaction from their new jobs than anything closely resembling their old ones. I met one gentleman on a coastal ferry from Portland to Seattle. He had worked in the licensing department for an advertising agency, specifically in charge of procuring the rights to classic rock songs for television commercials. Now he was a chimney sweep, given that most homes in Seattle had lost their central heat, and the winters were now longer and colder. He was seldom idle. "I help keep my neighbors warm," he said proudly. I know it sounds a little too Norman Rockwell, but I hear stories like that all the time. You see those shoes? I made them. That sweater, that's my sheep's wool. Like the corn, my garden. That was the upshot of a more localized system. It gave people the opportunity to see the fruits of their labor. It gave them a sense of individual pride to know that they were making a clear, concrete contribution to victory. It gave me a wonderful feeling that I was part of that. I needed that feeling. It kept me sane for the other part of my job. So much for talent. Tools are the weapons of war, and the industrial and logistical means by which those weapons are constructed.
He swivels in his chair, motioning to a picture above his desk. I lean closer and see that it's not a picture, but a framed label.
Ingredients: molasses from the United States, anise from Spain, licorice from France, vanilla, bourbon from Madagascar, cinnamon from Sri Lanka, cloves from Indonesia, wintergreen from China, pimento berry oil from Jamaica, balsam oil from Peru. And that's just for a bottle of peacetime root beer. We're not even talking about something like a desktop PC or a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier. Ask anyone how the Allies won the Second World War. Those with very little knowledge might answer it was our numbers or generalship. Those without any knowledge might point to techno-marvels like radar or the atom bomb.
Sinclair scowls.
Anyone with the most rudimentary understanding of that conflict will give you three real reasons. First, the ability to manufacture more materiel, more bullets, beans, and bandages than the enemy. Second, the natural resources available to manufacture that materiel. And third, the logistical means not only to transport those resources to the factories, but also to transport them out to the front lines. The Allies had the resources, industry, and logistics of an entire planet. The Axis, on the other hand, had to depend on what scant assets they could scrape up within their borders. This time, we were the Axis. The Living Dead controlled most of the world's landmass, while American war production depended on what could be harvested within the limits of the Western states, specifically. Forget raw materials from safe zones overseas. Our merchant fleet was crammed to the decks with refugees, while fuel shortages had dry-docked most of our navy. We had some advantages. California's agricultural base could at least erase the problem of starvation if it could be restructured. The citrus growers didn't go quietly. Neither did the ranchers. The beef barons who controlled so much prime potential farmland were the worst. You ever hear of Don Hill? You ever see the movie Roy Elliott did on him? It was when the infestation hit the San Joaquin Valley. The dead swarming over his fences, attacking his cattle, tearing them apart like African driver ants. And there he was in the middle of it all, shooting and hollering like Gregory Peck in Duel in the Sun. I dealt with him openly and honestly. As with everyone else, I gave him the choice. I reminded him that winter was coming and there were still a lot of very hungry people out there. I warned him that when the hordes of starving refugees showed up to finish what the Living Dead started, he'd have no government protection whatsoever. Hill was a brave, stubborn bastard, but he wasn't an idiot. He agreed to surrender his land and herd only on the condition that his and everyone else's breeding stock remained untouched. We shook on that. Tender, juicy steaks. Can you think of a better icon of our pre-war artificial standard of living? And yet it was that standard that ended up being our second great advantage. The only way to supplement our resource base was recycling. This was nothing new. The Israelis had started when they sealed their borders, and since then each nation had adopted it to one degree or another. None of their stockpiles, however, could even compare to what we had at our disposal. Think about what life was like in the pre-war America. Even those considered middle class enjoyed or took for granted a level of material comfort unheard of by any other nation at any other time in human history. The clothing, the kitchenware, the electronics, the automobiles, just in the Los Angeles basin alone, outnumbered the pre-war population by 3 to 1. The cars poured in by the millions, every house, every neighborhood. We had an entire industry of over 100,000 employees working 3 shifts, 7 days a week, collecting, cataloging, disassembling, storing and shipping parts and pieces to factories all over the coast. It was a little trouble, like with the cattle ranchers, people not wanting to turn over their Hummers or vintage Italian midlife crisis mobiles. It's funny, no gas to run them, but they still hung on anyway. Didn't bother me too much. They were a pleasure to deal with compared to the military establishment. Of all my adversaries, easily the most tenacious were the ones in uniform. I never had any direct control over any of their R&D. They were free to greenlight whatever they wanted. But given that almost all their programs were farmed out to civilian contractors and that those contractors depended on resources controlled by distress, I had de facto control. "You cannot mothball our stealth bombers," they would yell. "Who the blank do you think you are to cancel our production of tanks?" At first I tried to reason with them. "The M1 Abrams has a jet engine. Where are you going to find that kind of fuel? Why do you need stealth aircraft against an enemy that doesn't have radar?" I tried to make them see that given what we had to work with, as opposed to what we were facing, we simply had to get the largest return on our investment, or in their language, the most bang for our buck. They were insufferable, with their all-hours phone calls or just showing up in my office unannounced. I guess I can't really blame them, not after how we all treated them after the last brushfire war, and certainly not after almost having their asses handed to them at Yonkers. They were teetering on the edge of total collapse. A lot of them just needed somewhere to vent.
He grins confidently.
I started my career trading on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, so I can yell as hard and long as any professional drill sergeant. After each meeting, I'd expect the call, the one I'd been dreading and hoping for. "Mr. Sinclair, this is the president. I just want to thank you for the job you've done for us, and we'll no longer be requiring you." It never came. My guess is no one else wanted the job.
His smile fades.
I could have gone head-to-head against the military for the duration of the war, but I'm grateful in the end that I didn't have to. When Travis D'Ambrosio became chairman of the Joint Chiefs, he not only invented the resource-to-kill ratio, but developed a comprehensive strategy to employ it. I always listened to him when he told me a certain weapon system was vital. I trusted his opinion in matters like the new infantry BDU or the Stanford infantry rifle. What was so amazing was to see how the culture of RKR began to take hold among the rank and file. You'd hear soldiers talking on the street, in bars, or on the train. Why have X when for the same price you could have 10 Ys, which could kill 100 times as many Zs? Soldiers even began coming up with ideas on their own, inventing more cost-effective tools than we could have envisioned. I think they enjoyed it, improvising, adapting, outthinking the bureaucrats. The Marines surprised me the most. I'd always bought into the myth of the stupid jarhead, the knuckle-dragging, lock-jawed, testosterone-driven Neanderthal. I never knew that because the Corps always has to procure its assets through the Navy, and because admirals are never going to get too fired up about land warfare, that improvisation has had to be one of their most treasured virtues.
Sinclair points above my head to the opposite wall. On it hangs a heavy steel rod ending in what looks like a fusion of shovel and double-bladed battle axe. Its official designation is the Standard Infantry Entrenchment Tool, although to most, it is known as either the lobotomizer or simply the Lobo.
The Leathernecks came up with that one, using nothing but the steel of recycled cars. We made 23 million during the war.
He smiles with pride.
And they're still making them today.